is conspicuously absent, right? The things that could be, there's a certain kind of, I feel like Emil he unconsciously doesn't know that he's excluding these things already, because if that's how he understood his childhood as a child, that it's a world of light, that's not something a child can, you know, when a child is being unguarded and being safe, unless they have parents who have very subtly moved them or something.
I think there's two things. One, that come to my mind. One, for a moment, look, there are many different types of childhood, and many of them, we may or may not be able to have time to get into it, do not have this sort of unsullied, safe, innocent experience, right? Unfortunately. But we're going to bracket that for now because we're talking about this particular kind of idealized childhood experience, whatever, that many people do more or less have. So I think that there's that. I also think that kind of what you're saying relates back to there's no risk of failure, right? If one isn't fully inhabited in the world of light, especially as a child, even if you do something kind of wrong, as long as you do it in that world, right? As long as you mess up, then it's never really characterized as like an evil, right? As being sullied, right? Because it's a mistake. It can be repented. It's not intentional. It doesn't really affect one's way they inhabit. And I actually have a kind of an example for this, and I'll get to it in 2 seconds, but I want to read, because we're taught the importance of the day and night. He goes on immediately to mention the night, because these two worlds are obviously beside each other. He goes, "The other world, however, also began in the middle of our own house and was completely different. It smelt different, spoke different language, and made different claims and promises. This second world was peopled with servant girls and workmen, ghost stories and scandalous rumors, a gay tide of monsters, intriguing and frightful, mysterious things. It included the slaughterhouse and the prison, drunken and scolding women, cows in labor, foundered horses, tales of housebreaking, murder, and suicide. All these attractive and hideous, wild and cruel things were on every side, in the next street, the next neighborhood house. Policemen and tramps moved about in it. Drunkards beat their wives. Bunches of young women poured out of the factories in the evening. Old women could put a spell on you and make you ill. Thieves lived in the woods. Incendiaries were caught by mounted gendarmes. Everywhere you could smell this vigorous second world. Everywhere, that is, except in our house where my mother and father lived. There it was all goodness." So these two worlds are very clearly like beside each other, right? And it's the distinction of kind of being a child, one can sort of live fully imbibe in this world of day. The example that I thought of for myself when I look back is not, it's not something that I particularly did, but it's something that I kind of experienced, which is, and many of us did at the time, was I was 6 years old, 9/11. And what I mean by that is, I look back at that period, 6 years old, I'm not going to sit here and say I had like the most idealized childhood ever, like Damiana is talking about in this sort of like wondrous, you know, kind of late 19th century, I imagine, gardens and servant girls and, you know, perfection with the mother and father. But, you know, a relatively good at that point, innocent childhood feeling, right? Like that's when I kind of reflect on that. And I remember 9/11. I remember when that happened. And I remember watching it on TV before school, obviously big deal, very disturbing upon reflection. And I remember it not affecting me in that way. It affected me in some way because I remembered it, maybe because everybody was talking about it. Who knows? I just have snippets of memories. But it was not something that penetrated the world or broke the kind of seal, right? It was, I still went to school that day. I played with my friends. Basically, we didn't get it, even though everyone else was freaked out and, you know, and the world had changed significantly. It hadn't changed enough or hadn't changed my, like that safe zone was still very much there.
Yeah. That's an interesting example. I remember the day that I remember 9/11 too, and we saw it on the news and we went to school, and when we got to school, our teacher sat us down and told us what had happened. And I remember having this very particular feeling of like, not like, what does this have to do with me? But it was this distance of, there's something else, like there's something going on, but I'm not in the world where something else is going on. Like I could tell that all the adults were very concerned, and they felt that they needed to sort of wade us into that. But at the same time, I didn't feel like I needed to be prepared for that because I knew that I wasn't really a part of that world. So it's interesting. The one for you, it didn't break the seal for me either, but I feel like I'm getting the view that Demian is talking about, where it's like, I'm very aware that there are things going on outside, but that doesn't get inside, as it were.
Yeah, and just like kind of like you're saying, just like Demian said, like there's a whole, even as a child, aware of this sort of like the whisperers of house workers and people in the alleys and all this bad stuff going on, but the childhood is still sacred. But it doesn't stay that way forever, right? Like that's kind of the big question of, you know, what we're talking about today, the final sheet. And there's this great quote, as sort of discussing what it feels like when that starts to slip away. For the context of the listener, like I recommend you read the book. Basically, some stuff happens that's not really that serious, at least from my perspective, but is serious enough that it affects Emil in such a way that his world starts to break apart. He does something that he hides, basically. He commits a kind of sin and gets lulled in or trapped in a sort of continuing revolving door of committing small little sins to hide the next one, and that sort of dishonesty, that guilt really starts to, things begin to almost immediately shatter. Wall clock and table, Bible and mirror, bookshelf and pictures were likewise leaving me behind. I had to gaze at them with frozen heart as I saw my world, my good happy life, becoming a thing of the past and breaking away from me. There was no escaping the fact that new taproots held me firmly anchored in a dark and alien land. For the first time in my life, I was tasting death, and death tastes bitter, for it is its birth pangs, fear, and dread before some terrible renewal. I really like that, especially wall clock, table, Bible, mirror, bookshelf, pictures likewise leaving me behind. Obviously, like, they're not actually slipping away. Like, you know, at least not literally sitting there and somebody that's moving. But what he's saying is, as a young person, he is now re-entering the safe world. In particular, I talked about his family's home, childhood home. The things that he encounters, the phenomena that he encounters, they have different meanings now. Things are in a transitionary period. The Bible, the clock, the house, the family, these things are no longer showing themselves, and he is no longer interacting with them in the way that he used to in that innocent day of light. Childhood world. That world has slipped by.
The fact that that world just is composed of those things, that everydayness is composed of engaging with, you know, keeping your school schedule with your clock, or whoever you like to study with for your Bible studies. The meaning of those change, and that changes the sort of tonality of the world itself. The way that you approach the objects in that world becomes different as well.
I always remember, I can't remember actually who said it, was some lecture I was listening to on phenomenology a long time ago. The lecturer asked, you know, what is the first thing what happens when you open your eyes in the morning? Like, what do you encounter? Is it the ceiling? Is it this? Is it the crud in your eyes? No, the first thing you encounter is meaning, right? Like, and not meaning itself, really, but the fact that the world is meaningful. You don't open your eyes and you're like, oh my God, what is this stuff? What is stuff? Oh, like, oh, you know, like, you encounter a world that is immediately meaningful. You understand that world. But how you understand those things can change, and they often can radically change, right? Like, another great example that we're kind of from talking about a childhood transition or that break, that childhood seal from day to kind of night, or the melding of those worlds is another example. Another great example is when there's a partnership and one partner dies or leaves or whatever. Suddenly, you know, let's say I have my, I with my partner, we have our room, we have all this stuff together. Blah, blah, blah. One day I get a call, they've passed away for whatever reason. And although you'd be in the same room, it's not hard to imagine that the room would mean and feel something very different. It would now, like it would now be a thing that reflects loss, missing space, right? Like, you're not interacting with their items in the same way you did the day before. They don't mean the same thing. And much for Emil, his world as a child, you do something, you change, your world changes too. And you can't encounter, he can no longer encounter this super child innocence that he was living in since he can remember.
Yeah. I think the case of, you know, the deceased partner kind of, it applies here to Emil's case as well. And I think specifically when he says that it's slipping away or he's falling behind it. The feeling of that meaning is in the absence of that world, right? One gets a kind of distance from it. I think even in the case of something like a deceased partner and living in that world, everything is still there. All the parts, well, obviously not everything at that point, but it's interesting that there's almost the experience of being able to see that world from the outside. Right? Its absence means you've stepped out of it and now you grasp it as a whole and you have some relationship to that world itself. Whereas before, you just were in that world, right? You were immersed in it. But now that it is, you're anticipating it going away in the case of Emil, or you actively are for Emil, you start to have a relationship with it. You start to form memories of it. You can start to miss it. You can start to regret what you did to cause, if you cause some kind of breakage in this immersion.
You know, and I think I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think that's actually a really interesting and astute point, which is, like, even this book, the prologue of this book opens, Emil, the character Emil, opens the book discussing how he is reflecting upon events, right? Like, he's writing, he's reflecting back. So, for example, like you said, the relationship when you lose a partner or become a widow or widower, you know, what you can only understand what that relationship really was as a whole once it's over, in the same way that Emil can only understand and describe to us his, you know, childhood of tables and Bibles and prayers and manners and safety in reflection. No child living in that is going to be able to fully articulate what that is when you are, like, immersed. In the same way, it's undoubtedly pretty hard in the midst of something like a romantic long-term relationship to articulate what that whole thing means while you're in the midst of that. It's much easier for the much older person at the end of the life, presumably lost a partner, or it's just kind of like, you know, the twilight time, to look back and describe to someone what that was and how it was and how it interacted and happened. Things need to close to be seen sometimes.
Yeah, in a certain way, they have to have a kind of completeness to them, right? I mean, if the phenomenon that you're talking about is your own experience, an interpretation of that experience or an experience of the meaning of that experience has to be outside of the experience of that thing itself, as it were. That's sort of the asymptotic limit of phenomenology, is as much as you absolutely can describe your own experiences, but the fact that you're putting them into language means that they've gone through all kinds of processes and stuff like that. The more interesting one is this idea that the experience of meaning is itself an experience of something else, right?
Yeah, it kind of comes back to, like, once that kind of seal of, I kind of like the term virginity, like, once that virginity is kind of broken, you can't get it back, right? Like, you can't, you just, like, you can't return there. He said, I escaped into this harmony with real emotion, trying to go back into his parents' world. I could never be thankful enough at having regained my peace of mind and my parents' confidence. I became a model homeboy. I played more than ever with my sisters. At evening prayers, I sang all the favorite hymns with feelings of homecomer who was saved. It came from the heart. There was nothing false about it. And yet my house was not really in order. Basically, it doesn't matter. Like he's saying, like I played the part as super well, like even better than before, because I knew what it was, because it could be, as we're kind of saying, kind of been a completed thing. So that's when one can act. But acting is not being there, right? It's not actually imbibing this. It's not, you know, actually living it out. And he knows that, right? This character knows that even though he's trying to regain his childhood and re-enter this, you know, fantastical kind of safe childhood realm, that world of day, it's been sullied in such a way that it's not actually accessible, no matter how hard he tries, right? Which kind of leads, I think, into the last point we can talk about, which is touched on in the book, which is how the sort of idealized childhood life world often becomes what many people seek to return to, right? Right, many people cannot really face up to the fact that it's gone, that it dies for everyone. Right, he says this. There's a few good quotes here, but it's speaking specifically about how grown-ups can't actually understand it. He says, "The grown-up who has learned to translate a part of his feelings into thoughts misses these thoughts in the child." And therefore, finally denies even the experiences themselves. So thinking about like what childhood is actually like, living out in that childhood thing. Basically, I'll read the quote one more time. It's a little rapey. It says, the grown-up who has learned to translate a part of his feelings into thoughts misses these thoughts in the child and therefore finally denies even the experiences themselves. When I read that, my interpretation of what Hess or Emile is reflecting there is, there's a way of sort of not just of kind of thoughtlessness, of feeling that childs inhabit in this safe, this kind of like the world of day, the childhood world, that you can't actually think out, right? You can't actually formulaically figure it out, but adults will try to attempt that. And in doing so, they will always skip over the most necessary parts, right? They will always skip over what is essential and create something new and kind of false. Again, because you can't capture, you know, the lightning in a bottle type thing, right? It's the feelings, the experiences, the phenomena of this sort of idyllic lived from childhood life. You know, it makes me think a lot about, ironically, you know, the kind of 1960s hippie movement and people like that, where it's like, I'm going to become like a flower child and, you know, just like get on a bus. And I personally know people who are kind of like this, right? But the thing is like there's this kind of child wonder to it, this whole aspect, and a lot of also usually a lot of like kind of childlike like imagery, you know, with kind of like the hippie and the fairy and the forest and the kind of like, you know, a lot of sort of fantasy imagery and stuff like that. But it's always like also imbued with like basically people partying. Like it's just a front like for more standardized adult behavior.
I think specifically that there's a more, just not like sinister, but there's just a basic structure to the experience of wanting to go back that makes it impossible to go back. And it's just that when you were a child, you weren't trying to get back to anything. If you were, it was like you want to go back home because you want to get a snack or something, or you want to go back because you forgot something, you know. You're not going back in that experience, you're not going originally back to that experience itself, right? Any kind of experience where you're just trying to get back to a certain experience is always going to undermine itself. I think that you can produce new meanings by finding something else to do with those kind of desires and stop chasing something that you can't get back to and instead turn them to new spontaneous ideas, which weirdly enough, will put you back in the position of the child, because the child just was being spontaneous themselves. But this idea as well, I think it's keenly seen. You're seeing this rightly in the hippie movement, was the idea of returning to something, but it was never really, there was never really, you know, it was never really fairies in the forest to begin with. Unless it maybe, you know, unless you maybe took the fairy tales a bit seriously as a kid.
Well, and some roads don't go back, right? Like some roads only go one way. There's an interesting kind of our last quote we'll discuss, which really wraps up this whole transition, is every man goes through this period of crisis. For the average man, it is the point in his life when the demands of his own fate are most at odds with his environment, when the way ahead is most hardly won. For many, it is the only time in their lives when they experience the dying and resurrection is our lot. During the decay and slow collapse of childhood, we are abandoned by everything we love and suddenly feel the loneliness and deathliness cold of the world around us. And a great many people stay forever hanging on this cliff and cling desperately their whole life to this irrevocable past, the dream of the lost paradise, which is the worst and most ruthless of all dreams. We kind of call this period adolescence in a way, right? There is, everyone is expected, right, if you have an idealized, let's say, let's just, we're safe for the sake of discussion, we're talking about kind of idealized or decent childhoods or whatever, right? Relative innocence, you know, however you want to look at it. Everybody has to go through a period of leaving that behind. Facing up to mortality more generally is a big part of that process. But also, too, facing up to the fact that one lives many periods, or one could even say one lives many selves, and self-understandings and understandings of worlds and worlds that we inhabit, and those come and go, right? And it's accepting that those sorts of things are both not just the people in your life, but also yourself will change dramatically. And that change process is just a part of being a person. However, you can basically ride it like a wave. Like you can be like a surfer out there being like, here's the next one. Like, I got to ride this in. Like, we're on this kind of journey. Or you can push against the current, right? You can always be like, I'm trying to get back to that specific point that where I felt the most comfortable, where I felt the most safe. You know, I'm always going to get back to paradise. And so I'm going to organize and orient myself and my life in such a way that it will appear to me as if I'm on a path that looks like it's going in that direction, right? Even though it's very clear, as we've talked about for many reasons already, it's just not like a logically possible. It's not a real possibility for you.
It's like, yeah, it's not even a possibility that is permitted to be a possibility at all. You can't create the conditions for this to happen.
But a lot of also facing up adolescence is realizing that, you know, there is things like guilt and, you know, and shame and mistakes and failure and death and mortality. And people do have choices, and individuals do, you know, and you will fail. And you have to face up to that. And there is not going to always be a safety net, a world in which those things don't really have meaning, like in Emile's day, like world of day, where even, you know, mistakes and failures can, even if they were very like limited, can always sort of be washed out or accounted for within the context of this safe, you know, and kind of cuddling zone that one lives in and an idealized childhood. I have felt that pull, and I do personally know people who want to recreate those conditions. And there's many ways, and there's many ways of doing that, whether that be through our own actions or also too, if I'm being frank, people creating their own families for reasons that seem to be wanting to recreate what they once had. You know, it's simply part of, as I think Hess is really trying to illustrate, part of becoming a full and authentic person, or being as much a person as one can be, is always facing up to the fact that one cannot return to what was, right? What has ended, what is over, however it ends, whether it's by one's own doing or not, is like, it's simply not a part of the being of that kind of entity, of that kind of space, to be re-inhabited.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there, it's interesting, right? If I, you can almost think, I mean, I don't know if I want to, yeah, okay, I guess I'll bring these in. Like, if you look at no drama, so an old form of Japanese drama, it's casted by ghosts, ghosts of people who can't move on, right? The priest will go to a setting and there's a ghost who can't let go. And they literally haunt that space and kind of relive it over and over and over. And there's always a ghastly effect when the sort of resolution of the play plays about what is keeping them stuck in this place. And if you want to move beyond that eerie kind of contextless, because what you're doing is you're isolating yourself to one world when the world is moving on, right? If you want to avoid that, and if you want to kind of remain alive in the world, and you want to, I don't want to say like emit authenticity, but be authentic and be in step with, you know, the, I know we're using this metaphor of the flow, very O'Leary.
Yeah. The wave, whatever. Yeah.
But it, I mean, they're trying to gesture towards something true, as kind of formulaic as people like O'Leary or the hippies would have initiated you into that, right? Again, it's not, because it's a matter of a person's, a particular person's authenticity, you can't prescribe how to enter into that, right? You have to figure that out for yourself. And at the same time, there's going to be like structural, you know, problems, like trying to hold on to a past life.
I want to thank everyone for listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show, and we hope you'll join us next week.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, online at cjsf.ca, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC, home of McFog the Dog.
This is Bird Note. For years, nature recordist Lang Elliott came up with clever ways to hear high-pitched bird songs, despite his high-frequency hearing loss. Back in the 70s, he recorded birds on tape at high speed, then played the tape back at half speed. Slowing the songs down also lowered their pitch.
And boom! Oh my God, there's twice as many, three times as many birds in the forest singing now as I had perceived. There's this flood of birdsong going on, and I'm detecting a very small part of it.
Lang's hearing loss is from a childhood accident, but many people lose their high-frequency hearing due to aging.
So there are a lot of birders who, as they get older, they start losing grasshopper sparrow or Cape May warbler, especially the high warblers.
Lang teamed up with a programmer to develop an app called Hear Birds Again. Currently, it's only available for Apple devices, but it's able to take high-pitched bird songs and shift them down into a lower range. The app works even better with a special binaural headset so that users can tell whether a sound is coming from the right or left.
Detecting a bird without any spatial element is useful, but what's fun is hearing it as if it's out there in a 3D environment, being able to point toward it, being able to actually go find it.
Learn more on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Jonice Franklin.
Speak up. Speak up.